Who's Talking with DZ Martin is brought to you by Crook's Corner, home of shrimp and grits, and Bill Smith's Season to the South menu. Join us at 610 West Franklin. Daily menu at crookscorner.com.
This is DG Martin, and this is Who's Talking, and I bet you're about as happy as I am that finally the generals have told it like it is and come to bat and urged Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld to resign, and they've given good and cogent reasons why his service has been has been bad, and that it's about time that he stepped down. But Dick Cone, our friend who comes to guide us and give us wisdom on all matters relating to defense and the United States' policy and its history of the armed forces, is with me today. Dick, you've written an article for Time magazine which urges us to be very cautious and wary of this development of even retired generals criticizing our civilian officers. And I wonder if you'd share with us your thoughts.
DG, I think the bottom line, I'll start right out front, is whether we want the President of the United States and the Secretary of Defense accountable to the Army, retired or active duty. That's just not the way our government works. The essay is actually on time.com. They said they didn't have room in the issue, not enough pages. But my concern, and it's really a very deep concern, it's very disturbing, that senior professional officers, after a lifetime of service, who follow the code of silence when they're on active duty, except when they're asked their opinion or when they volunteer their opinion inside the building in private as advice to their superiors or to the civilian superiors, would break this code and come out and attack a sitting Secretary of Defense in the middle of a war, a Secretary of Defense they served. If they were just private citizens, certainly they have the right to do that. If they were just private citizens, then their first name wouldn't be General, and they wouldn't be highlighting their military service and their positions of responsibility and command and being in the know as a way of adding credibility to what they say. So what they do is to make a policy recommendation, not advice, but to argue policy, and to close what is or will certainly become a partisan act in the neutral, patriotic, apolitical clothing of military service. I think it misleads the public. I think it really speaks, as one of them actually wrote in Time magazine last week, that he was encouraged to make these remarks by people on active duty inside the building, which is certainly an act contrary to our codes and ethics of civilian control of the military. I think this is an act that not only undermines civilian control, but furthers the politicization of our military. And I'd make a third point. It poisons the civil-military relationship, and it does so in two ways. First, it encourages, drives the civilians to appoint to our senior military leadership people whom they can count on not to hang up their uniform and attack the policy or the politicians. And they won't, perhaps, more likely, won't use a professional experience, competence, accomplishment, strong-mindedness, candor as the chief qualifications to appoint people to high command. And second of all, they are less likely to have a candid, frank exchange of views and dialogue in the process of making policy and making decisions, because it's very likely that the civilians, the next Secretary of Defense, or even this Secretary of Defense, says, I better not share my thinking. I better not think out loud. I shouldn't reveal my true intentions or influences on me in front of this person. They'll retire, and I'll hear about it in the newspapers. And the military person on the other side says, well, if I say this, the Secretary might think that, or they'll spin my views, or they won't believe me. They'll think I'm setting them up for my memoirs. There was a very telling cartoon in the yesterday's N&O by Jeff Danziger. It shows a fighter plane in the attack mode with a bomb under it, Rumsfeld in the back seat, and the pilot is out on the wing about to jump off with his parachute, and he says, "Well, I'd like to stay, but I've signed a contract to write a book about what a jerk you are." I think this is really a very negative thing, and I'll make one last point to our friends who, like me, think Secretary Rumsfeld has been a terrible Secretary of Defense and who think that this war was a strategic miscalculation of historic proportions, and that is, if there was anything calculated to keep Mr. Rumsfeld in office with this president, it's six retired generals calling for his resignation.
Let me ask you, just to probe a little bit, how about, if you can, summarizing this doctrine of how a military officer or a general officer or a high-ranking officer is under the code required to limit his or her comments while on active duty or thereafter?
Well, I have to do it on active duty first, and then we need to talk about what kind of professional ethic carries over into retirement for people who become generals and admirals, that is, the topmost ranks. You have to start with the question of what is the role of the military in American society or any society. It's to defend the nation. It is not to make policy or to make the final decisions at the highest level of grand strategy or strategy, but to advise the civilians on the basis of their military experience and military issues, often taking into account the political, because at the highest level, one cannot separate raison d'etat, reasons of state, from the actual military means that may be, in certain circumstances, necessary to be used to achieve them. So the role of the military person is to advise. Often it is to advise forcefully and strongly and pound the table and to insist upon their views being heard all the way up the chain of command, if necessary, to the president. But it's to speak in, not to speak out, to be candid and insistent in, not to threaten the civilians. There is no tradition of resignation in the American military. And it would be improper to threaten resignation, because to threaten resignation or to actually do it and then to blast the policy is to undermine civilian control of the military. And then once the decision is made, it is the job of the military to execute that decision, to follow orders as long as they are legal orders, that they don't violate the law. And there are teams of lawyers, including your son, in the military, some of whom advise commanders and senior commanders as to the proper way to accomplish military things within the law. And so this advise and then execute is truly their function. Of course, there are many other functions that the military fulfills, but I'm talking about the relationship at the top of our military between the military and civilian leadership.
Dick, how does it, in terms of the duty of the military to provide advice, what is the duty of a general officer who is called upon to testify, say, before Congress and to answer the questions? Well, is his or her job to explain the policies of the civilian leadership and defend them, or to answer candidly the questions that the civilian legislative branch puts to the officer? What is the code of support?
That is
required?
That is exactly the next question, DG. And the answer is both. They go before the Congress regularly with hearings or at special hearings, and they defend the policy. But then when they are asked by congressmen or women or senators? What is their personal opinion or what is their professional opinion? They have every obligation and every legal obligation to speak the truth as they know it and to be full and candid and comprehensive with their own views. At every job of the three-star or four-star, these people have to come before the Senate and become confirmed. And often they have to go and subject themselves to hearings. And every time they are asked by the senators, when you come before us, will you give us your candid personal and professional opinions about these matters? And if they don't answer yes, I can assure you they are not going to be confirmed in these jobs. And that's the proper avenue for military people to make their views known. And if they don't do it, they are really violating their professional code and their oath, because in fact the Congress exercises civilian control over the military in different ways, but just as powerful and just as important ways as the executive branch does.
The concerns that many people register, I guess, have to do with the much talked about testimony of General Shinseki at the time the Iraq War was about to begin, about the requirements for more troops than the civilian leadership in coordination, I suppose, with the military leadership allocated for that for the Iraq operation. So the question, I guess, is, and I think I know the answer, is it appropriate for the civilian military leadership to discipline officers for sharing their candid opinions?
No, it's not. And I think General Shinseki acted properly. He was badgered and pushed into a corner to give a number. And the number was not his function. He knew the number was much higher than was being offered by the strategy, and he knew it was a number that the civilians didn't want to hear. Rick Shinseki is a professional officer of the highest code, and he follows his civilian leadership, and he believes in civilian control. But when pushed by the Congress, he gave an answer. Mr. Rumsfeld and Mr. Wolfowitz then proceeded to trash him in public as part, in my judgment, of a campaign in the spring, the late winter and spring of 2003 to sell the Iraq War to the American people as something easy, quick, and cheap. And it may be that they sincerely believed it would be easy, quick, and cheap, and there's much evidence that they did. But there's also evidence that they had to make the sale in those terms. And if one can fault the military leadership at that time, it's only that they didn't question those assumptions more strongly. We don't know at this point in time what they really believed. We do know that Mr. Rumsfeld has practiced a form of intimidation against the military almost from the moment he came into office. And it has had its effects. There's no question about that. Whether General Shinseki believes strongly that we were about to make a huge mistake or not, we do not know. He has practiced, rightly so, the code of silence. We don't know what General Myers believed in the late winter and spring of 2003, or General Pace, or the other chiefs. If they believed that there was about to be a huge mistake made, then they should have voiced that more strongly in private, and they should have taken the opportunity, as was their obligation when asked their personal opinions before the Congress, to say so. But I don't know what their personal and professional beliefs were at that time, and one only hopes that when the time is appropriate, that is when this administration is out of office, they will speak frankly and fully to historians and journalists, and they will write their memoirs.
Well, what is the obligation of general officers who in their own minds are enthusiastically supportive of the policy decisions of the civilian leadership? Are they are they required to keep silent as well, or are they obligated to jump to the defense if they of the administration if they feel that the administration is right. I guess what I'm saying is the job to stay silent if you disapprove only, or is it their job to stay silent, period?
I believe their job is to stay silent on the subject of policy. They are not supposed to be flacking for the administration on issues of policy. When General Myers, who's in fact a very good friend of mine from my Air Force days, came down at the end of February in 2003, he visited us. He spoke to our Triangle Institute for Security Studies. He attended a basketball game on March the 1st, got a round of very enthusiastic and heartfelt applause at the Smith Center when he said that the United States faced a greater danger in the war on terror than anything since the Civil War, and made the point about there being a connection between Iraq and Al-Qaeda. I took him to task at breakfast the next morning, and I said to him, You should not be saying that. I said, not only is it not credible and is there no evidence, but your role is not to defend the policy or to promote the policy. Your job is a strictly military one. And in fact, I wrote a paper for him on that subject. So I guess I'm an equal opportunity critic. But I do believe that the politicians, and this goes back long and deep into our history, will use the military for their own purposes. They'll get them to endorse presidential candidates. They'll get them to promulgate the policy. The military have a very special role in America, viewed very specially by the American people. And the politicians of all parties will use them to the full extent. And the military has to prevent that. They of course have to support the policy when they're called upon by Congress, but to engage in speaking campaigns or to get up in press conferences and be presenting on policy, I think is wrong.
Dick Cone, let's take a quick break. We'll be right back to talk a little bit more about your concerns about the criticism by retired Army and by retired generals of the of Secretary Rumsfeld. We'll be right back.
People sometimes ask me, does it really matter what clothes I wear? Who cares? It's just a pair of pants and a shirt, right? This is Missy Julian Fox of Julian's on Franklin Street. We believe clothing is a way to express yourself and who you are. People respond to a well-dressed man. You assume he is thoughtful, smart, savvy, pays attention to detail, well-read. Interesting combinations show creativity and even some risk-taking skills. And not being well-dressed can give the impression of, oops, quite the opposite. We feel so strongly in the power and value of quality. Once you experience the look and comfort of a good fit that only quality workmanship can supply, be it in a suit or shirt or well-designed necktie, you will understand the value and longevity of your dollars well spent. Let us help you be that well-dressed, comfortable, and confident man of great style.
Julian's on Franklin Street, where you find tradition with a twist.
Relax, indulge, enjoy as Playmakers Repertory Company presents Cyrano de Bergerac by Edmund Rostand, now through May 7th. Bravery, passion, and crime collide in this dramatic, classic story of a soldier and poet who believes his physical appearance prevents him from pursuing love. During the play, you'll be captivated as he pours out his heart in poetic love letters, all while hiding his real identity behind the beautiful face of another man. For tickets, go to playmakersrep.org or call 962-PLAY. Playmakers Repertory Company, celebrating 30 years of excellence.
Who's Talking with D.C. Martin is brought to you by Crook's Corner, home of shrimp and grits, and Bill Smith's Seasoned in the South menu. Join us at 610 West Franklin. Daily menu at crookscorner.com.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm talking to Dick Cone, the professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and the chair of the curriculum in Peace, War, and Defense, and someone who's concerned about the criticism of Secretary Rumsfeld, Dick, I'm assuming not because of the content, but because of the people who are delivering the criticism and the circumstances in which they're doing it.
That's exactly right, D.G., and it's a much more ticklish and difficult a problem when you are dealing with retired senior officers. Certainly every retired officer has the legal and constitutional right to speak their mind. I don't believe there's any doubt about that. And if they are, of course, lower ranking than general or admiral, they get much less press and much less attraction out in society, and so I'm not concerned about that. What I am concerned about is the most senior people, particularly 4 stars and 3 stars, who've had the positions of highest responsibility, speaking out on political matters. I'm not opposed to them giving their views and their opinions if immediately after retiring they do it in private. And put it under wraps. We want them to talk to historians and to journalists. We need to know what happened, and we need to know as fully and candidly what their views are. But for them to go public, they need to wait until an administration is out of office, because otherwise they are undermining, they are using their military experience and their military persona. If they are critical, they are using it to undermine the policy. If they are not critical, they're using it to promote the policy. And I've insisted from the beginning of our conversation that the role of the military is not a policy or political one. And so I think they have to, because they've enjoyed the high responsibility and continue to enjoy the high respect of the American people and the government, they have certain professional obligations. These are not legal obligations. These are obligations that are crucial to the relationship of the military to society and to the relationship of the military to the civilian within the government. And their behavior after they retire, particularly immediately after they retire, and the more so the more sensitive positions they've had, is one that's very sensitive and can do real damage to the United States. There's even some criticism about them second-guessing military campaigns and operations as advisors or interpreters to the media, radio, television, etc. I think they are, as I've witnessed them, and I know one or more of them, they are very responsible. They get information from the Pentagon, and they do everything in their power to help explain to the American people, but also to keep faith with the troops and not endanger them, nor endanger the military operations themselves.
Dick, it seems to me that the implementation of the doctrine in the strict form that you would require puts the American people in a little bit of a box in the sense that the civilian leadership says that they are providing all the resources that the military request, and that any civilian questions with respect to the implementation of the policy is disloyal in the sense that it civilian criticism undermines the troops and undermines the leadership of the Army. And if you are sort of stuck in that position, the only way that you can get good, credible military commentary about the policies and about the implementation of the policies, if you should agree with it, is from those experts who are in the military and have been on site and have been experienced directly the consequences of the leadership that under your doctrine they're forbidden from criticizing.
No, I don't think so, DG, because there are many senior military people who are far, far removed from being in office, who can provide a commentary and often do. But you have to remember that the senior military enjoy a very special role and status in American society. The American people have multiple sources of information. It's not just the retired military who are very skilled and very knowledgeable in military affairs. There are academics, there are journalists, there are public rank of people. There are people in Congress who are knowledgeable and who can speak out. Nothing that these six retired generals have said, by the way, is not well known in the national security community. Many of the points they made have been made for years, not only about the Iraq campaign and the Afghanistan campaign, but about Mr. Rumsfeld's style of leadership, his abusiveness, his mistakes, his indecisiveness, his interference and micromanagement, and some of his specific decisions. All of this is well known in Washington, well known, I think, in the Congress. And in fact, several Republican senators have called for his removal. So I don't think that these retired generals are saying anything that's so new or that the American people needed to hear from them. What makes this so public and so notorious is the fact that they are recently serving retired generals. It is, in fact, their political act that is the news here, and it's the political implications of what they are doing that is the news here, not the informing of the public.
Well, it is the news that because they feel so, you could arguably, because they feel so strongly about it, they have
broken the code of silence, broken a professional code.
Well, they made a moral judgment that that in the measuring the two wrongs, silence versus speaking out, and there would be a code which says when things are so terrible, you have to speak out, and there's a code that says your professional job is to keep silent. That in weighing those, some of them have made a determination that the importance of speaking out, notwithstanding the code, is more important. And some those who agree with them would probably say they've made a fine moral choice.
Well, that's true. But I will tell you, Wednesday night at our Passover Seder, a very dear friend of mine, a very distinguished physician who was born and raised in Germany and, in fact, lost his father in the Second World War, pressed me very strongly about this and raised the question of the German generals in World War II. And my response to him was is that we are a long way from that kind of situation, a very, very, very long way. And in no way are we in a comparable situation to an illegal and ruthless and brutal and murderous government of the Third Reich.
Well, I would agree with you about that.
Okay.
I think all of us.
Well,
thank goodness.
That's what jumps into people's minds, though, because they immediately come up with hypothetical situations. And I think the moral choice that these generals felt was only part of their motivation. Of course, I speculate here. They feel a responsibility to the troops.
Well, I would just argue with you about that because I don't think these guys are getting anywhere with their, you know, their ghetto, if you will, is
self-purification.
Everywhere they go, they're surrounded by their hundreds of retired generals who would agree with you about the code, and that these guys are risking being ostracized for a long time by their fellow officers who would agree with you, and that they have made a choice which probably seals for the rest of their lives an outsider status within a group that they would want to be insiders. Anyway,
yes, I think this marks them.
Yeah. Let's take a quick break, and we'll be right back and maybe argue a little bit. But I've got a question I want to ask you when we come back about General Tony Zinni's criticism as reported in a New York Times article this week. We'll be right back.
Did you know that skin is the largest organ in the human body? This is Sally La Liberté, family nurse practitioner with Central Dermatology. Did you realize that skin is the largest and most visible organ in the human body? About 20 square feet in an average-sized adult. Skin performs many essential tasks, such as regulating body temperature, protecting internal organs, providing sensation, and supporting metabolic functions. Its external location makes it susceptible to a wide variety of diseases, disorders, discolorations, and growths, as well as to damage from the environment and the aging process. This summer is the perfect time to learn how to keep your skin, hair, and nails healthy.
For medical or cosmetic questions about your skin, call Central Dermatology Center at 401-1994 or click on www.cdcskin.com. Central Dermatology is located on Highway 54 near the I-40 Exchange. Central Dermatology, protecting what protects you. Who's Talking with DZ Martin is brought to you by Crook's Corner, home of shrimp and grits, and Bill Smith's Seasoned in the South menu. Join us at 610 West Franklin. Daily menu at crookscorner.com.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. Dick Cohn and I are talking about the recent criticism of several retired generals about the performance of Secretary Rumsfeld. And Dick, you've been educating me about some of the underlying problems that aren't getting attention with the criticism of Army generals. And I mentioned to you that I read with interest a book review in the New York Times this week about a book by General Tony Zinni called The Battle for Peace. It's not a diatribe against anybody, but it is in it, he shares some of the recommendations that he'd made for preparation for the operations in Iraq that had been, that hadn't been taken up by the civilian leadership, that upon that looking backwards, some of the preparations for the sealing of the borders, for the maintenance of order in Iraq after the successful conquest, might have been better to follow some of his recommendations. Is he approaching it correctly in terms of, is he far enough away from it to be making commentary like this?
Well, General Zinni is a very special officer and a very well-known officer, and speaks with a particular authority, not only because of a very distinguished career, but because he was General Franks' predecessor as the commander of Central Command, responsible for that area of the world until the leader in the foreign policy. I was once with him and questioned how he was doing his goals and so on, and he explained that he was the one who formulated them and got them approved, and I said, well, then you are a pro-consul, and he looked at me and he said, well, I guess I am. And he used that term henceforth. This was at a conference at his command down in Tampa in 1998. So I've met General Zinni, and I know people who know him well, and I've followed his career. I've not read either of his books, Battle Ready, which came out in 1994, or this most recent one, although I did read the review that you mentioned. He's much more critical, according to this review, in his Battle Ready book of 1994, and he speaks with special passion, DG, because General Zinni retired from the military in September of 2000, the year 2000, and then immediately turned around and endorsed George Bush to be President of the United States, which I thought was improper, particularly since he had a very high position of responsibility under the Clinton-Gore administration. And then he became a special envoy to the Middle East, particularly to Israel in the Palestinian problem, soon in the new administration, and then left because he was angry with the administration's policy, and has since been very outspoken and critical of the Bush administration, and says he'll never, of course, endorse a presidential candidate again. So I think that when he speaks out as a little bit of a general who's been burned, and also a general who's very opinionated. For example, he will attack those of us who speak on national security affairs if we haven't served in the military or weren't in Vietnam, when we were the age of Vietnam, using what we in the business call the chicken hawk argument, which I think is beneath his dignity. The issue should be the good sense or the soundness of what we are saying, and not whether we have in our background a particular particular experience or being in combat. But my disagreements with General Zinni aside, he is an important spokesperson, whatever is motivating him, because he's a smart man, a well-read man, a man who has studied the Middle East, and a man who was responsible for our military policies and relationships from Western North Africa through to Pakistan in the late 1990s and up to the fall of 2000. And he believed very much that we should not be attacking Iraq. He supported the policy of containment in those years. And he thought from the very beginning of the Bush administration that an attack and an invasion and a seizing of Iraq would be a strategic miscalculation for the United States.
Well, Dick Cohn, I want to take a break, and then I want to come back and shift gears a little bit and talk to you about some of the other policy options that are facing this government and our country. Dick Cohn, and I'll be right back.
WCHL 1360. Time now for a biography for radio with Jack Perkins. Brought to you locally by the Cedars and East West Partners Community.
He was well into his 30s when he learned the truth about his family. It was scarier than a Hollywood movie. His story next on Biography for Radio.
Former Nesquik powder users are telling us why they switched to rich chocolate Ovaltine.
My girls don't like to drink white milk, and the only way I could get them to drink it was with chocolate milk. I'd seen on TV that Ovaltine has extra vitamins in it. Now I'm using it, and my girls love the taste. And they're drinking their milk, getting their calcium, and all the vitamins from Ovaltine. I stopped using Nesquik because it just doesn't have the vitamins that Ovaltine has.
Ovaltine. Try it for the nutrition. Keep buying it for the taste.
More Ovaltine, please!
He was born in New York in the late 1930s, but until 1974, he thought he was born in the place he grew up, Neptune, New Jersey. A journalist checking his background told him the truth. The woman the Hollywood star had thought of as his mother was actually his grandmother. To avoid scandal, she had raised him as her own after his birth to her teenage daughter. Even more shocking, his true mother was the person he had known as his sister for 37 years. He was stunned when he got the call, but by that time, nothing could stop him. He had started humbly, with roles in school plays and bit parts on TV. He even delivered messages for MGM. But directors soon discovered this was an actor who could be arrogant, frightening, and insanely charming all at once. Now we know him as the 3-time Oscar and 7-time Golden Globe winner for such films as One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, The Shining, Something's Gotta Give, and countless others. With his Cheshire Cat grin and Devil May Care attitude, he is Hollywood's star, Jack Nicholson. For Biography, I'm Lawrence Scott.
Biography is a trademark of A&D.
Biography for Radio, brought to you on WCHL by the Cedars of Chapel Hill and East West Partners Community. The Cedars is the country's premier retirement community. Call 929-1995 to find out more on this very special community. Life has been good to you. Now it gets even better at the Cedars of Chapel Hill. Who's Talking with D.Z. Martin is brought to you by Crook's Corner, home of shrimp and grits, and Bill Smith's Seasoned in the South menu. Join us at 610 West Franklin. Daily menu at crookscorner.com.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm talking to Dick Cohn. Professor Cohn is the chair of the curriculum in Peace, War, and Defense at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and is a nationally known commentator, figure, and scholar on military history and on military policy, particularly, Dick, on your concern about the relationship between the military and civilian life. And I appreciate your sharing with us your comments. While I've got you, though, I want you to talk to us about some of the other things that are going on in the Middle East. First, Iraq, and now We find that our civilian leadership is rattling its saber in the direction of Iran. And you have to concede, as they point out, that Iran presents a very potentially dangerous situation, not just for our interest, but for the entire world's interest. And I wonder how you – we're at the beginning of this, and I wonder how you are beginning to size it up.
My view of Iran is that it would be not at all helpful to the United States or to the world community for Iran to get nuclear weapons. I accept the news reports and the interpretation of our leadership that they are moving in that direction. I don't know whether they are seeking nuclear weapons as a way of defending themselves against attack or with the intention of using them aggressively. But my own feeling is that Iran is a state, and there is no evidence whatsoever that deterrence does not work when you are dealing with a state. Were they to use a nuclear weapon, they would get back in kind the kind of devastation that one can only imagine in one's worst nightmare. The question is whether they are led by irrational zealots who would use a nuclear weapon anyway, particularly against Israel. I don't believe that the possession of nuclear weapons would be a great danger to the United States, particularly except insofar as it would destabilize the Middle East. Certainly they could use them against our forces in the Middle East. But again, they would suffer retaliation of the most ugly and devastating kind. So I think that there is going on now a complex and very ambiguous diplomacy of threat of various kinds to try to abort a nuclear weapons program in Iran. I think it's wise to try to do so, but I think that the leaking of material by people who that led to Seymour Hersh's article in The New Yorker and to other kinds of things that seem to be seeping out, and the president and the Secretary of State's statements are part of that. There is a larger problem here, DG, that really disturbs me, and that's the unraveling of the nuclear proliferation protocols and regimes that have governed the international community in the last 30 years. Pakistan and India have become nuclear powers. It's very obvious that Japan could become a nuclear power very quickly if it was necessary. We don't want to build up in arms races in South Asia, but in the triangular relationship between Pakistan, India, and China, any kind of a nuclear arms race would be very dangerous because it is likely then to involve Japan, and then there is North Korea on the other side of China that causes a concern. So it's not just Iran and it's not just nuclear weapons. I think the chances of them giving a nuclear weapon to terrorists is pretty small. And I think if one's to believe the news reports, that it's probably years before they have a nuclear weapon. But the real question is how do we stop nuclear technology and weapons from, over the course of years or even decades, seeping out such that they fall into the hands of people who are crazy enough or are murderous enough to use them. The great danger is if they get into the hands of non-state groups against whom retaliation or deterrence wouldn't really work. That is, deterrence wouldn't work and retaliation wouldn't be possible.
It really, in many ways, seems to demand a reassessment of what our world order is, in the sense that you have a state like Iran, which is a state like the United States or Great Britain that has its rights, and you can't interfere with them without breaking international law. But on the other hand, if you think of 200 different states having nuclear capabilities, it becomes a world in which would be quite a bit more dangerous than it is today.
Well, it's really the New World Disorder, and apparently that's the theme of General Zinni's book, that it's the real important date is 1989 and the end of the Cold War, not the attack on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. And
it's kind of tough to go with him and be reminiscent of the times when we had two big guys who sort of kept order, and now we got one big guy who can't seem to keep order.
Well, two big guys who had thousands of nuclear weapons on hair trigger alert against each other, with the danger of blowing up the world, right, at least for the first half of that Cold War.
I'm still thankful for 1989, General Zinni.
So am I, and it is a better world. But I think I really do think that the spread of nuclear weapons into the world would be a disaster. And I think that, you know, our old views of sovereignty being pure and unfettered under the system we've had since the middle of the 17th century has really been dissipating. D.G., there are so many international laws and international conventions and norms and values, international organizations, non-governmental organizations, international businesses, that the old idea of sovereignty being pure, I think, is in many ways obsolete. And when I hear our politicians beat the nationalism drum and refuse to consider treaties and protocols on global warming and on the International Criminal Court, I think to myself how retro they are, and how they are not acting in the best interests of the United States. We want countries to act responsibly, and we want them to feel bound by certain norms and values that we help establish.
Dick Cone, we'll have to continue this conversation, and I want to on another occasion. Thanks so much for sharing your wisdom with us and for cautioning us about our glee in having people go after Secretary Rumsfeld.
My pleasure.
Thanks to Dick Cone, who's been our guest. He is the chair of the curriculum on peace, war, and defense at the University of North Carolina. Thanks to all y'all for listening. We'll be back same time tomorrow.
At work, in the car. News Talk 1360, WCHL, Chapel Hill, Carrboro's News Talk and Tar Heel Station.